Welcome to the Boston Book Festival. I haven't been here all of the years. Maybe I must have missed one. We're very grateful for Sun, and not because we, as Harvard Review, are in the tent, in a tent on the plaza. So we are always pray for no rain, so today's great. I'm going to moderate the session. I'm going to briefly introduce our authors, and then we'll get started asking them questions. Pardon me? Oh, okay, the book signing. Yes, I'll get to that, but I will also mention it right away. There is a book signing at the end of the session, and I will remind you at the end of the session that there is a book signing at the end of the session. And the book signing will be directly that way, at the end of the hall, in the room known as the Boylston Room. So we're going to have plenty of time for questions. That's the other thing I want to do. So I want you all to be thinking about your questions while we talk. So our three authors, the session's called Creative Lives. All of the works on this panel, the novels that have been written by these authors, have a major literary or artistic figure at the center. So that's kind of the organizing principle here. Now, our authors in alpha order are, at the end, Lindsay Hatton. Lindsay has an MFA in creative writing from NYU. She grew up in Monterey, California, where she spent summers working at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. This is pertinent because her debut novel, Monterey Bay, is set in and around and in relationship to Steinbeck's Cannery Row. Dawn Tripp, right here. Sorry, that wasn't alpha. It's in order here. Dawn Tripp is a winner of the Massachusetts Book Award for fiction and the author of three novels set in New England, Moontide, The Season of Open Water, and Game of Secrets. Her essays appeared in various publications and other places, including, I like this, Psychology Today and NPR. Her most recent work, Georgia, is about the life of Georgia O'Keeffe. And Denisha Smith, here on my left, is a writer, teacher, novelist whose work includes the New York Times notable book, The Illusionist. She's a recipient of fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Ingram Merrill Foundation, and has taught at Columbia and Breadloaf Writers Conference. Her most recent novel, The Honeymoon, is a fictionalized account of George Eliot's late marriage to a much younger man. So, what I thought we should do is I thought we should start off by having our authors describe briefly their own books. So, Lindsay, why don't we start with you?
Sure. My book is called Monterey Bay. I'll do the showcase showdown. It's a lot of things, but most of all, it's an imagined founding history of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which is one of the most magnificent aquariums in the world. It mostly takes place, however, in 1940, when the aquarium was not even a thing yet. 1940 on Steinbeck's Cannery Row, where a young girl named Margot Fisk arrives in town and falls deeply and tragically and star-crossedly in love with John Steinbeck's best friend, Ed Ricketts, who is best known as Doc in Steinbeck's Cannery Row. And then part of the book also takes place in 1998, and that's when you learn my invented creation myth of how Margot grows up to be the founder of the world's greatest aquarium.
Dawn?
So Georgia is a novel about the American artist Georgia O'Keeffe, and it really focuses not so much on the O'Keeffe we know, but how she became the O'Keeffe we know. So the novel is set between 1916 and 1933, which were really O'Keeffe's New York years. So those are the years, her East Coast life, like those were the years where her art was first discovered. Those were the years where she fell in love, craved a child, had her heart broken, was betrayed. Those were the years where she, you know, her relationship with Alfred Stieglitz, who was famed modern art promoter and the father of modern photography, really that relationship, that love affair and subsequent marriage, and also his support of her art, really shaped our, in many ways, our understanding of who she was as a writer. But there's layers of mythology as I began to dig into the research into, you know, the way we've perceived her art. So the sort of sexualized and feminized imagery that we tend to wrap around her art was really not what she was doing. You know, she was a key innovator in American abstraction. But that kind of intent and vision has largely been kind of subsumed by the eroticization of her work, and that conflict, that sort of power struggle over her brand during the 20s between her and Alfred Stieglitz, and also their love affair, were the key dimensions that I wanted to explore in this novel.
Okay, Tanisha.
My novel is about a little known aspect of George Eliot's life. When she was 60 years old, her beloved companion of 26 years, George Henry Lewis, died. And she was, there was a family friend, their banker, their financial advisor. He was young, handsome, rich, 40 years old. He begged her to marry him. They wrote back on their honeymoon how happy they were, how wonderful it was. Then they reached Venice, and he made a suicide attempt by jumping off the balcony of the hotel and begged the gondoliers not to rescue him. He seemed to recover. They went back to England, moved into their new house, which is now owned by Michael Bloomberg, on Cheyne Walk. And they, 3 months later, she was dead. Now, nobody really knows what happened. They lied. They said he had had typhus. She said he had had an illness due to lack of exercise. So this mystery, what was this marriage about? What did they want from it? What was it, a tragedy, or was there some redeeming aspect to their love? And that's the subject of this novel. And then I, in order to understand it, I went back into her life. And there you are.
Well, so as I was reading these novels and thinking about them, I have lots of different questions, but I'm going to cut to the one that interests me the most, because I get to do that. So I do a lot of historical research, and I'm really interested in how people handle documentary evidence, mm-hmm. documentary material. So these are really major figures, and there is a lot of stuff about them out there. So the question for me, or for you, actually, you have to answer, is I want to know how you handled the research aspect. So here are the kinds of things that you might think about. Sort of, you know, you all mentioned, by the way, books that were very important. All of them have sections in the novels where they say, I read all these books were really important to me, and they call out certain ones that seem really important. So that's very helpful and interesting, I think, to readers. So how did you use the sources? Did you feel constrained by the documentary record? Did you feel stimulated by the documentary record? I know that there's a letters issue in Dinesh's case. Right. Did you feel there was too much? God knows I might have. Did you feel you'd never be able to read everything? You know, so, and then how did you use this material in your work? So maybe Dinesh, because I know there's a letters story there.
Well, I had many years as a reporter in the culture section of the New York Times, and I had an allegiance to the truth. I vowed not to go against known facts. What the advantage for the novel was, so little is known of her real, George Eliot's, interior passions. First, she was, despite her irregular relationship with George Henry Lewis, extremely proper. She didn't confide in her diaries or her letters. I had an affair with Herbert Spencer. I was in love with Herbert Spencer. So that was where I had room to fictionalize this story. And it was inspired by creating her inner life, by what other people said about her, by her poetry, by hints in her documents, or her diaries. But I made a decision I wouldn't go against the known truth. That is, in terms of the chronology, the people she interacted with, what's known about this young man, about whom very little is known. So that was how I did it. I don't know if I answered your question. The research was kind of fun. It's my first novel that's set in an historical period. My husband happens to be an historian, so that was a big help in locating sources, deciding how to interpret them, learning to live in the 19th century as opposed to the 21st century or wherever we are. And so that was how it came about.
So I actually came to O'Keeffe's story through her art, and specifically a show of her abstractions that I saw at the Whitney Museum of American Art. And for me, that show was a revelation. But I'm just bringing that up because even though it's not the written material that I would go on to explore, I used her catalog raisonné, and I used, you know, there were certain, that whole sort of evolution of her work as an abstract artist was something that was critical to the evolution of the story that I, you know, that I chose to focus on, that dimension of her life, 1916 to 1933. When I left that show at the Whitney in 2009, I actually read 5 biographies back to back of O'Keeffe, and what struck me in those biographies is that even though there was a similarity of facts, it was like 5 different women had been described. And I was fascinated by this. I was fascinated by, there were just these little, and there were these little discrepancies that I noticed. And the more I began to explore, the more I realized that the discrepancies in the biography and the variety of interpretation really came because there'd been so much mythologizing around the life and the art of Georgia O'Keeffe, and specifically her relationship with Alfred Stieglitz and that period of time in the 1920s where she really became the O'Keeffe we know. In the first year of work on the novel, I actually couldn't find the voice of the novel, and for me, voice is a critical, I have to really own the voice of the story before I can sit down and write it. So in that first year, I read 9 biographies total, and I read about 20 catalogs from different shows, because I feel like curators and art historians have a very different insight than biographers into the lives and mind of the artists that they study. And during that first year of work, I actually stayed away from reading anything that was written in O'Keeffe's own voice, so her letters, her memoirs. And it wasn't until I found the voice of the novel that I went into her letters and her memoirs. And the letters actually became a critical setting right of the historical record. Because I too, like Denisha, really felt almost an obligation to stay as close as I could to the historical record, even though I was writing a novel first person from O'Keeffe's point of view with imagined thoughts and dialogue. In those imagined thoughts and dialogue and fragments of scene, they're woven in all of these little pieces from her letters and from her memoirs, specifically her letters that were exchanged with Stieglitz.
So I should just mention that there is a little bit of a difference with Lindsay's work because Steinbeck appears as a character, but only kind of every once in a while.
Right.
And there is it's more of a departure. It's more the text of Cannery Row that underlies rather than the character of John Steinbeck. But he's there.
He's very much there.
Yeah, so I wondered how you handled that.
Yeah, it was so interesting hearing both of your responses. Because a lot of it echoes and also departs from my own approach to research and historical fidelity. Steinbeck is a relatively minor character in my book, but I wanted to respect his legacy and not depart too far from historical fact. For me, the most helpful way I was able to get inside his head and justify things that he might do or say is through letters and journals. I was kind of drowning in biographies and critical treatments of him, which entered my mind as a fiction writer in a non-productive way. They were warring agendas that I had to somehow leave behind, and for me, primary sources was the big clarifying moment. I was so lucky that he left behind so many journals and letters. And so I tried to remain very true to him and to his friend Ed Steinbeck, who was also a real person, and another man who left behind a lot of his own writings. As far as the other part of the book, that founding history of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, I went almost completely off the rails with my own imaginative treatment of it. As far as things like animal care, exhibit logistics, a few of the bits and pieces of the more humorous tales of little accidents that happened when the aquarium was still in its early days, those are true. But as far as my main character who grows up to found the Monterey Bay Aquarium, she's an invented character, an invented composite of some other literary and historical figures, but she bears no relationship in terms of personality or intention to the aquarium's real founder. The aquarium's real founder is a woman named Julie Packard, and by all accounts, she is a very reasonable, kind person, and therefore no fun to write about. so I had to make someone a little bit more intense and have those driving forces behind her of unrequited love and revenge and ambition. And alongside that too, my own experience growing up on Cannery Row. I worked at that aquarium when I was younger, and Monterey is my hometown. I knew the real history of the Monterey Bay Aquarium. I had done my research to figure out how it came to be, but deep down in my soul, I always sensed an alternate founding tale, something, a true mythology. So that's what I ended up doing, bolstered by research, yes, but also with major flights of imagination in there too.
So when I first got the assignment for this panel, I thought, oh, this is like one of my favorite parlor games. And it's the list of books that do similar kinds of things. So I started making these lists, and then I realized, oh, no, these books are all doing different kinds of things. So this is my categorization. And I'd be very interested later if you have other ideas about this, because I'm compiling a great list. It's like the key to all mythologies. So there are books based on other books. So, you know, Ulysses and the Odyssey, or the various Jane Eyre. You know, there's the Margot Livesey's Jane Eyre, and Death Comes to Pemberley. I like that one. That's Pride and Prejudice, as is Bridget Jones's Diary. Books about minor characters in novels. So, like, Jean Rhys's The Wide Sargasso Sea, which is about Mrs. Rochester, the madwoman in the attic, whose story hasn't been told. Then there are books about famous authors, which is sort of more the kind of territory that we're in a little bit, although it's kind of a cross here. Michael Cunningham's The Hours or Comte Tobin's The Master come to mind. So I was wondering if when you started this project, you read other people's attempts to do things kind of like this, and whether you have examples that you loved, examples that you hated, examples that you were intimidated by, whatever. So Dawn, why don't you start?
So when I set out to write this, I had in mind a novel. It was a national bestseller, I think, in the 90s. It's called I Was Amelia Earhart, Jane Mendelsohn. I adored that novel because it was lyric, it was poetic, it was shifting in time and place and point of view. And I absolutely had this really fractured, experimental dimension to it that, and also Catherine Harrison's Versailles, which was a retelling of a period of time in Catherine Davis's retelling of Versailles, which was a retelling of a dimension of time in Marie Antoinette's life. And those two books were what I wanted to do with Georgia. And Georgia didn't want to be written that way. And as I really wrestled with the story in that first year and a half of work, I realized that this would have to be a very linear, driving, straightforward, lean, taut, direct novel. And I'd never written a book like that. And it's not always it wasn't the book I was called to write, but it felt like that was the book, that was the only way that voice, that Georgia O'Keeffe voice, was gonna tell the story to me.
Lindsay?
Most of the books I read to fortify myself mostly dealt with the challenge I dealt with here, which is that mix between historical fiction and speculative fiction and how to ride that edge. E.L. Doctorow does that beautifully. Peter Carey does that beautifully.
Jack Maggs.
What's that?
Jack Maggs.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then David Mitchell, too. Some of his The Thousand Autumns of Jacob DeZoet does a beautiful job with that as well. Yeah, I just tried to get some courage by reading those people who did a great job with the crossover. But you mentioned The Master. That was one of the books that scared the heck out of me, because I'm like, oh man, this is this is more than I can do. I just ended up approaching it differently, and there were plenty of emboldening figures out there, which is good.
You've added another category to my parlor game.
Oh, what is it?
Denisha?
The Master, very important. Comte Tobin couldn't do it. I couldn't write that book. I mean, it's a very, you might call it subtle. It's about not desiring and not fulfilling desires, avoiding. It's beautifully subtle, but I felt, as you did, that I, perhaps it's the allegiance to my old profession, I wanted my novel to be very clear and exact and no decoration. And an issue, by the way, because of the 19th century milieu that I'm writing about, where the prose was just gorgeous, and so I had to keep it clean, as they say. But then also, David Lodge wrote a book about Henry James, which was published not far from the time that Colm Tóibín's novel about Henry James was published, which was probably a bit of a crisis for David Lodge, and because Tóibín's came out first. David Lodge also wrote a biographical novel about H.G. Wells, which these were much probably longer novels, though Lodge's style is closer to one I'm comfortable with. It's, as we call it, clean, straightforward. So those books sort of came into play.
Not being a novelist, I'm not sure, and you've sort of touched on this, but this is a first. So, Lindsay, this is your first novel, and you two have both written other novels, but not historical novels, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right. So, two questions. One is, why did you decide to write a historical novel? And the other is, will you do it? Would you do it again? I mean, you have to now write your second novel, so are you going to do it again?
I am. I don't know why. I have no idea why. This didn't start out as a historical novel. I wanted it to be present day, Monterey Bay Aquarium, Cannery Row, but the more I researched and the more I got into it, it seemed like I would be making a huge mistake not to incorporate the historical elements of that time. So it ended up happening that way, but I didn't intend it. And I guess I enjoyed it so much that I'm doing it again. So there you go.
Do you want to tell us what it is?
I reserve the rights. Well, I'm kind of excited about it, so yes. I'll say something, but just briefly. It kind of goes back and forth in time between Wall Street in the year 2000 and Prohibition era Hollywood. There's a young investment banker, a man who thinks he may or may not be possessed by the demon spirit of a female silent film star. So, again, all that could be changed, but right now I'm having a lot of fun.
Denisha?
I am starting up a novel which I now have decided is an historical novel. I'm not sure if I'm going to do it, but having written George Eliot, this book, The Honeymoon, gave me the courage because many, many years ago I began a novel about Jerusalem, and this was in, I guess, in 1987, 1988. And I never finished it because I'd have to go back to Jerusalem, I'd have to immerse myself again. But now I realize it is an historical novel because Jerusalem has changed so extraordinarily since 1987. It's a book about the first Intifada. I don't know if it's gonna work, but I'm trying. This gave me some courage because I realized there are ways of finding out what happened in the past and that are accessible to me. So
it's funny when you said Jerusalem in a historical novel and then you said 1987. I thought, really? I think the potential for deeper history is there.
Well, it's just that the first Intifada, the first, right, as it's known, Arab uprising, it occurred in January of 1987, or December, excuse me, of 1987, and it changed Jerusalem profoundly. The routes cars can take, the signage of the cars, everything was profoundly altered. So my fear of going back to that was somewhat dissolved or cured because I had already done it in the 19th century. Okay, I can do Jerusalem, I'll try. I'm not sure it's going to happen, but we'll see.
Done.
So my first three novels were historical novels, but they weren't based on an historical figure. So they're three historical novels that are set in the small town where I live, which actually creates its own set of conflicts and crises since I live there. Ah. But the novel that I'm working on next is actually another biographical novel. So it's another novel about a well-known person. But what I found with Georgia is that even though we think we know her, There is so much about her that is not known, particularly about this dimension of her life, these New York years. And I felt that there were so many little details that I needed to kind of seam in so that the reader would always feel entirely grounded, because I couldn't assume that the reader would know all of these details about O'Keefe's life. So I've actually chosen, and that kept me, I don't know, it's not that it kept me straitjacketed, but it kept me grounded in a way that I didn't always want to be grounded as an artist. And so actually the new novel I'm working on is about someone who the details of their life are much more well known, which will allow me to kind of move around a little bit more and be a little more creative in the way that I'd like to be.
So, you know, listening to you say that, it's kind of interesting. One of the things that I think happens when you read these stories, when they're well told and they're compelling, is that you begin to replace the real person with the fictional character in your mind, so that the novel actually begins to kind of overtake, maybe say, you know how biographies have a coolness to them, because they sort of keep their distance from the subject. They tell you the facts, but they tend not to overstep that. Like, people don't of course, there's every kind of biography in the world, but sort of theoretically, they're kind of not overstepping what can be known. And obviously, that's what fiction allows you to do, is it allows you to step over beyond what can be known into what you imagine might be known. But there's this weird thing that happens then when I read them and I go, oh, this is what happened. Which, do you ever worry about that?
Yes.
Yeah, Denisha, you...
I actually found that there were biographies about O'Keefe that took many more liberties than I would have taken in my novel, that felt offensive to me.
So you felt as though you were truer, you were hewing closer to the truth.
I felt like I was working. I feel like I can stand by all the decisions that I made because I felt this kind of obligation to... you know, to be as true to her story as I could be, because she's been so misinterpreted or kind of wrapped up in mythologies. Yeah. So I do think there's a tone sometimes to biographies that there's this this sense that this is the actual fact. But there's a degree of interpolation and interpretation, even in a nonfiction account.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I actually fascinated by this question. First of all, I thought, you know, so hard about portraying her inner life, which is the unknown factor. I will say I am convinced that I was right.
There you go.
I mean, I'm not usually arrogant, but I think that I thought this through so much and that I feel I did learn to know her. But there is, in the question of biography and biographical fiction, is so fascinating because there are people, as we discussed, a friend of ours, a fellow author in the audience, there are people who say that history is a fiction, that biography is a fiction, because always the narrator's consciousness is controlling the author's consciousness is controlling the narrator or the characters, selecting which details to incorporate, how to interpret these lives. So that, I feel, is a bit of a postmodern theory, but there's an interesting thing to contemplate there. And
yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, like I said before, I found biographies had too much of an agenda for me to actually use well. And on top of that, Steinbeck and Ricketts, in my book, I'm teasing out a part of their biographies, of their actual recorded past, that has been a bit overlooked because it's very controversial. The protagonist in my book is 15 years old when she has her love affair, which is sexual, with Ed Ricketts, and he is 43 at the time. And Steinbeck not only condones it, but jokes about it in a very, let's say, locker room manner. And I knew I might be taken to task for that, and I have been. But there are literally, I could write an annotated version of this book that that has the exact references I took from Ricketts and Steinbeck's own words and from the biographies. I was very, very careful about that. The quote that I love, when Steinbeck was eulogizing Ricketts, And he says it again in a very jokey locker room way. When I first met Ed Ricketts, he was in the scholarly and persistent process of deflowering a young girl. And I'm like, hold up. Who was this girl? And her name was Eugenia Lovejoy, and she was 17 years old. So these things actually happened.
So one of the other things that struck me, I work in Pacific history, and I, at the moment, am deeply immersed in things like archaeology and, you know, ask me about radiocarbon dating. You know, I mean, like a very nerdy scientific kind of world in my head. So when I read these novels, one of the things that struck me was they're all love stories. Is that what people write about? Is that what everybody's doing? They're all writing love stories? So tell me about that. Tell me about writing a novel and writing a love story, because I was kind of struck by that. I had originally thought the organizing principle was this central, historical, literary kind of figure, and then I realized, oh no, the organizing principle is love story, which I wasn't anticipating somehow. Was that stupid of me? Denisha?
Well, many great novels are love stories, I actually have something to say about love stories, which is my students, I caution them not to write about sex instead of plot development, which they often will, those of you who've taught. And I point them towards the British newspaper, The Guardian's contest on bad writing about sex. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's hilarious. They gave Norman Mailer a Lifetime Achievement Award. And John Updike is also honored, and so are a number of writers. But that's not really what you're asking. I think that, well, first of all, it's very hard to write about sex, but love is everything, isn't it? I mean, love or not love, lack of love, as in The Master, the novel about Henry James, where he could not let himself love another man, even though in his heart, perhaps he wanted to, but he always steps back, right? You know, always. So I think it's the basis of every human evolution, and you know.
I think that's on page 3 or 4 of Georgia. Georgia says, you know, this is not a love story. If it were, we would have the same story. But he has his, and I have mine. And I feel like it's too, their relationship was too complex to be called, and too charged to be called a love story. There was this really brilliant, nuanced, intensity to the passion between them that was, it wasn't just sexual, although it was that, but it was also creative and philosophic and existential and, deeply artistic. O'Keefe, at the end of her life, described in her memoir Stieglitz in the sense of being with him. It was as if something hot, dark, and destructive was hitched to the highest, brightest star. And for me, that quote really became an engine, something, a touchstone for me as I continue to, shape the arc of their relationship. And I do feel there's a dimension of their love affair that's, a very key part of the novel. But I also think it's about the tension that this, woman feels between her, her passion for her art and her relationship, and the sort of the choices and the sacrifices that she has to make in each in order to, become the artist that she wants to become and that she believes she's meant to become.
Some of that probably resonates with you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this, the romance in this book was kind of a fait accompli from the very beginning. Like I mentioned before, I worked at the Monterey Bay Aquarium as a young person and had my heart just smashed into a million pieces there. And so I can't look or write or think about captive fish without thinking about tragic romance. So we don't go to the New England Aquarium a lot as a family because it's too rough for me. But yeah, and it's but again that question of Ed Ricketts' actual real life younger woman proclivities seemed to me like something that should be explored fictionally or otherwise, and seemed to dovetail with my own experience. I did not have a relationship with a 43-year-old man, but I was the same age as my protagonist in this book, and I know very well those desperate, horrible, inflammatory feelings of first love, especially when it's not going right. So I was excited to write about it, if to purge the demons, if nothing else.
That's great. That was three really different answers to the same question. That was really interesting. Well, I think it's time for us to take questions from the audience. So I hope you all have questions. I want to remind you, in case I didn't mention it before, that there will be a book signing afterwards. Oh, there's another thing I want to remind you, and this is not the moment for it, but I'm going to say it anyway. There's also a Vespa raffle, if you haven't heard about it. And if you're not a Vespa rider, you surely have someone in your family who's a Vespa rider. The Vespa raffle is in support of the Boston Book Festival, and I really recommend that you go and drop $10 into a plastic jar in support of the Boston Book Festival, and maybe you'll get a Vespa. But anyway, so questions. Can I take some questions for our authors? Yes?
Take away from microphone.
Oh, okay, thanks. Wait for a microphone.
This. I have a question about something you touched on. You said you could write an entire annotated version. Well, my question is, I understand how biographers and historians annotate what they're doing. And I wonder, when you're writing a novel which is based on an actual person, is there at any point any kind of copyright issue about how much of a letter you can quote and those sorts of things?
So that, it probably depends on the age of the author. I mean,
exactly.
George Eliot would probably.
I was fine because anything she's written that has been published is out of copyright. There are some papers that have not been published, but all her papers, her husband destroyed anything that would make her look less than a saint. So there you are. But
I actually have gotten to be really close friends with the lawyer I worked with at Random House on this particular novel, and yeah, they're very strict. I mean, because the letters, there are little pieces of letters that I use throughout the novel. There are little pieces from other, and we just went through page after page after page after page. And I actually keep an annotated version in my own record, so I knew what I needed to ask about once I understood the parameters of what was, what we could use or not use. But we spent a lot of time, going back and forth to get it right and just make sure that I had not taken too much from any particular place, but also that I referenced every single place that I took something from in my author's note and how I used it, because that was really important to me. It was important to me to be able to use it in order to shape the narrative in a way that I felt was true to the historical record, but I also wanted to own what I had used and the work of the scholars before me, that have built this amazing resource about the life of Georgia O'Keeffe.
Yeah, my experience was similar to that. My annotated version would be shorter than yours because Steinbeck is a relatively minor character in the book. But yeah, I was very careful, and the lawyers at Penguin Press were as well. The Steinbeck estate actually was my biggest hurdle to get them on board. Steinbeck is a cranky man in my book. In 1940, he was going through a terrible divorce. The Grapes of Wrath had just been published to great acclaim, but instead of making him happy, that made him miserable. And so he was hiding out in his friend's biological laboratory to soothe his weary soul. And who arrives on the scene but this young woman, Margot, who just pisses him off immediately. So the Steinbeck in my book is not a wholeheartedly positive figure, and the Steinbeck estate was not on board with it. So this is the book the Steinbeck estate does not want you to read.
get it now. How did you handle that? What happened?
It was nothing legal. It was just, they didn't want to co-promote with Steinbeck Titles, which is totally understandable.
Right.
But, yeah.
Right. Yes. Or, well, let me, there was somebody over here. Sorry, yeah?
Well, my question is for Dawn Tripp, and I want to preface it with, I just was passionate about your book.
Thank you.
And I have recommended it to so many people. But I recommended to one person who is a professor of art history, and she was very suspect. And I recommended, I said, no, I think you need to have all the kids in your class read this book, because she teaches, you know, contemporary art, modern art. And she said, well, it could be so speculative. I said, duh, yeah, but read the author note. And I wondered if you have received any art historians protesting. It didn't wreck my friendship with this woman, but it could have.
Don't let that happen.
Did you say protest? Did you say, have I received any protest or... Yep. So I have not, but I was paired with an O'Keeffe scholar for a book event in April at a bookstore. And the bookstore owner, who's wonderful and very passionate about Georgia, said, I'm so excited, I'm going to pair you with an O'Keeffe scholar. And I said, I really want her to read the book before she agrees to be paired with me. And so, because I was anxious, you know, I was really anxious that that she would not feel that I had done justice, to the historical record. But she read it, she loved it, and she was really supportive of what I had done. And she's someone whose opinion I value. She knows O'Keeffe's family members. And she's been very supportive of the novel. So, I mean, I haven't had a lot of contact, but I have done events at museums, and I've been, you know, supported in those events. But I understand your friend's kind of concern about it, because I do think that there's a fair amount of historical fiction out there that it's a spectrum. You know, as we were talking about, like, there's all different ways of approaching an historical figure. You can use that historical figure as a jumping off point to create an embellished fictional account, or you can use that historical figure as an organizing principle to tell that kind of more experiential truth that fiction can get into.
Yeah.
Especially with George Eliot in Georgia, I'm curious if you had an ongoing, or what kind of dialogue you actually had with them when you're talking about being true to sources, and I'm wondering where they were in your inner life while you were writing.
A dialogue with sources or with the character?
Well, with George O'Keeffe or with George Eliot while you were writing.
Was I talking to her? Well, I had the wonderful experience as I was writing. I decided maybe I am her. You know, because she is the literary heroine for so many of us. And, you know, she's the one that went before us. So I decided I too was an awkward, sort of terribly shy kid, but I overcame it. You know, so that was, she was also a very good human being. I think she was generous, kind. She had a very dry, caustic wit. But yes, that was the dialogue I had with her.
That was sort of, I was thinking the same thing. To what extent were they channeling their subjects?
So that question for me is really a kind of reckoning throughout the 6 years that it took me to write this novel. Because I was writing about a period, and I knew this going in, I knew that I was writing about a period of time in O'Keeffe's life that as an older woman she really sought to distance herself from. And I had to And part of it was coming to terms with that dimension of her. You know, that dimension of her as an older woman who really sought to distance herself from this period of time as a younger woman. And part of the way that I feel like I came to terms with it was it's not so much channeling, because I don't really feel like, I don't necessarily believe that that's what I'm doing. But I do feel like I really had to be able to say to her, like if she was standing in front of me, no, don't you understand? Like these years that were a kind of crucible for you, these were the years that forged your greatness. You know, not just because of what Stieglitz or anyone else did to you or for you, but for how you met and overcame the gender bias and the challenges you faced as a woman, as a young woman, in an art world that was dominated by men. So being able to kind of own that in relationship to her was important to me. Does that answer your question? Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
So I never really channeled Steinbeck. I mean, if I could have, it would have been a better book, because he's a very good writer. But I saw his presence in my working life as more of, I have like a little love seat next to my desk, and I imagined him always reclining on that love seat, arguing with me, or praising me when I did it right. And then I would imagine us having a beer together and having just some good-natured, spicy repartee. I think I would have liked him a lot as a person. But I do write about some things he did that weren't great, and that was always a challenge for me. I wanted to stay true to the legacy that we all respect, and rightfully so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Dawn, you had mentioned earlier how you struggled with finding the voice of your your novel. And I was curious if Lindsay and Denisha also struggled with finding the voice or any kind of execution of the actual writing process of the execution of the manuscript as you were grappling with the historical research as it was shaping the course of the narrative.
Great question.
Yeah, Denisha? I'm happy to answer that because I did struggle. For example, when I'm writing a novel, I cannot read Henry James because I start writing a bad imitation. I can't write that way. With her, I had to make a very big decision. Here she wrote the most gorgeous Victorian prose with lots of clauses. I had to decide, I'm going to write very clean, very clear. I'm not going to try with her. Dialogue was interesting. I allowed myself to use contractions where she might not have always used them, certainly in her books. But so it was a big decision for me how to do this voice. Yeah.
I was just going to intercede that you should definitely read, if you read these books, then you should also read some of their source material to get that feeling of how they're kind of bouncing. Because I was telling Lindsay that I was on a plane yesterday and I was listening to Cannery Row, and I, you know, as an audio thing. And so I was very interested. I'm interested to hear what you have to say about Steinbeck and the problem
I couldn't imitate Steinbeck's voice if my life depended on it. There are some techniques he uses that I love, and then I tried to incorporate in my book. I love his panoramic geographies and how he will slowly narrow them down to a turtle, you know, or to some other smaller thing that then provides us entree into a scene. So like technical aspects of his I tried to incorporate. But as far as the voice in the book, the voice of Margot Fisk, my protagonist, was there with me from the beginning. And through research, it was only intensified. I will betray my California heritage by saying that I had some cosmic affirmations along the way that told me I was on the right track with her. Just other women in the lives of Steinbeck and in the writing of Steinbeck and in the Monterey Peninsula area that were very, very similar to her in terms of their intensity and their ambition and ruthlessness. The tone was consistent and continually fortified over the course of the 10 years it took to write the book.
Questions?
I think Judith had one. Did you have a question, Judith?
I did. I cut you off.
Oh,
it's true. No?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Stand by.
Well, I think a lot of people have asked my question, but I'll reformulate it one more time. I think it's all the same question all the time. It's obvious that, especially in the case of these three writers, truth in terms of facts are done deal. I mean, you're too happy when you have the facts that you can somehow organize your creativity around things that are established. So my question is more about how do you fill the gaps? What is that process? I imagine it must cause tremendous anxiety because when do you know? When do you know? I mean, between you and you, when you go back to your own reaction or when you try to figure out, you completely absence yourself, you completely block your own emotion and try to piece together what that person would do according to the facts you have accumulated. And I'm really curious because I think at the end of the day, this is that moment where the artist's voice comes out, which is this place which is neither you nor the other, but it's sufficiently universal that it gets to the enigma of human nature. So I wondered, in the three of you, how much anxiety and what goes through your mind when you are finally confronted with a gap in the material that you have to fill with your own imagination and your own creative process.
The dangerous gap in the material.
For me, it was probably the least problematic for all of us up here, considering the fact that Steinbeck is a minor character in the book, and when there was a gap, I just kind of put him off stage. Again, all of his motivations in my book are very well rooted in things he actually said and did, so I didn't have too much trouble in that regard. But as far as like the logistics was difficult, you know, who was going to be where, when, does that fit novelistically in the same way that it does historically? That was a headache for me, trying to put those pieces together.
I would describe the anxiety as pretty constant because I was always guessing or intuitively deciding, but there is a feeling, and I'm sure my colleagues agree, and those novelists who are in the audience, you just know it just feels right, and when it's wrong, I personally have to take a nap on the couch near my desk. Frankly, that's what I do. If it feels wrong and I just can't do it, I've done it, right? And it feels bad, off to sleep.
It's such a great question. And I think it's such an important question. I do know that I would, in earlier drafts, so I'm a draft writer. So I write many, 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 many drafts. Many, like many drafts of a novel. And in my next to last draft, I read the book through and I saw the places that didn't ring true. You know, that just, they didn't ring true. And the book was already in galleys. And and I went back and I changed everything that didn't ring true. And I feel like it's something that, I mean, maybe Denisha has that gut feeling from the start. For me, it's a slower growing experience where by the end of a novel, when I've worked it through again and again and again, I feel like I've kind of, I just feel like I've kind of owned or come to terms with the voice and the material, and I just know deeply, like when something isn't working the way it should work. And so then when there are those gaps, and there weren't a lot with O'Keefe because there were so many sources, and their letters provided insights into things, into scenes that had happened between them, these private moments between them, like an argument that had never been documented before in any of the biographies. And the letters would be after they had separated, you know, she had gone off to Maine or to New Mexico and was writing to him, but they would refer to things that had taken place. And so then what I would do is I would go back and I would sort of build out the scene where that kind of disagreement took place in order to kind of, you know, fill out the book. But it was a process It was an evolution. It wasn't something that I could say I got it the first time or even the second time. Thanks.
I think we are out of time, and I want to thank our writers. The Vespa raffle is in the middle of the plaza, apparently. The book signing is, if I didn't say this already, at the end of the hall. And I do hope you'll go and get your books and get your books signed. That's how we support writers. Thank you very much for coming.